This is Monocle on Design, the show that brings you the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up...
Of course, the logo design, it follows the trends, like what happens in culture overall. Like, it's very connected to the time.
Can a simple logo convey a sophisticated message? We speak to Helsinki-based creative agency Kokkoro and Mui about its latest project, and later ask why some logos of a fair few of the world's biggest fashion brands are starting to look a little similar. Plus,
the architects conceived a neo-Gothic tower, a cathedral of sorts to both journalism and to commerce.
We bring the view from the top with a special report on a Chicago landmark, the Tribune Tower. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design, on Monocle 24, with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Now, Helsinki-based Kokkoro and Moi is one of Finland's leading creative agencies. It's known in its native Finland for designing several visual identities of citywide importance, such as the emblem of Finland's centenary in 2017, who can forget that, the rebranding of Helsinki's Old Town, and the logo type for Helsinki City Public Transport. Our Helsinki correspondent, Petri Bertsov, sat down with Kokkoro and Moi's CEO and creative director, Antti Hinkola, at his studio. Petri started by asking Antti about the design process behind the logo and visual identity for Helsinki's Regional Transport Authority, HRT, WUSH.
An identity consists of other elements as well. Like there's typography, there's colors, there's probably some other graphic elements, patterns, icons, etc. So logo is just like one element. And often when we design identities, the logo comes last. First we design the other elements and then the logo is kind of signature. For this case, which was started 7-8 years ago, we designed identity and approach was for the whole identity was we wanted to be like very human-centric and make very friendly identity with round shapes and soft color palette. And the logo itself, it's built with these 8 loops. It looks kind of like the abstract flower. And we call it the flower of the stone city. It's a cell with their vehicles, like colorful trams and buses and metros going in the city, like the gray city, like they bring some color in the city. And the logo is symbolizing that.
The fact that you designed the logo last, does it make the process somehow easier when you have already established the visual identity?
When we design identities, we try to build elements with some contrast to each other. So often we leave the logo in the end, and depending on the other elements, it depends what do you do then with the logo. Like for example, if you design identity with some bold press elements, like let's say stripes and strong colors, then perhaps for the logo you want to have some contrast and make it sophisticated or romantic or so on.
And do you have some logo specialists in your staff? Is it always a specific group who gets to design the logo, or does kind of everybody do everything?
Yes, well, we are all graphic designers in our agency, and we are all involved in this identity design process. But of course, sometimes it's if it's a typographic element, then we have a couple of guys who are more focused on typography, like custom typography. Sometimes if it's about more like symbol on or illustration-based approach, some people have better strengths in those areas.
So what about if you think about logo design and how it has changed and developed in recent decades? Do you see modern logos, are they, in your opinion, are they very different from logos from 70s, 80s, 90s?
Of course, the logo design, it follows the trends, like what happens in culture overall, like visual culture and what happens in graphic design and what happens in typography. It's very, very connected to the time when they are designed. But of course, you can see also like what other things influence the logo design is, of course, what kind of tools you have, you can use. There was this short era in, I think, 90s or end of 80s. There was some of these 3D logos, and it was a very short period, luckily. And now we are back again, like this more simple and minimal logo designs.
What about the move to the digital world? Logos are perhaps less and less printed on paper and on surfaces, and they're more just viewed on screen. Does that change somehow the design process of the logo?
Yeah, of course, there's more and more these different touch points, and often like in the very small size screens and so on. So I'm sure it has an effect. Logos are more simple and stronger that way.
Looking into the future, curious to know if you think that there will still be need to design logos in the future. And why do you think it is that human beings, why do we need logos? What is their primary function?
I think it's a fundamental power when it comes to symbols from the beginning of human history. Like, people have visualized the world around them with symbols, and that's something that's not going to disappear, whatever happens in the world. And of course, nowadays, there's more and more brands, not only companies, but people are branding themselves. So there's going to be more and more logos as well.
Oh, you mean like designing logos for just people? Essentially.
Yeah, definitely. That's something like brands are not only companies, but they are also people and other things.
So I don't know how much you can talk about the design for the presidential coat of arms, but that's super interesting and I suppose very important nationally. Can you share some secret details of that project?
Maybe only the process. There was quite a lot of going back and forth with some heraldic issues. Yes, it's quite a trick what you can play with when you fine-tune elements in the coat of arms.
But why did that? Do you know why the president's office wanted to fine-tune if it's a historic coat of arms?
Yeah, it was mainly based on like the very bad quality of the coat of arms they were used. They had this version like from, I don't know, maybe from 70s or 80s, and when you zoomed in like and had a closer look, it was very badly done. So it was more about first digitalizing the old logo, but then also like fine-tuning the details to make it more modern and stronger.
I wanted to ask you about another project that you were involved in, that was designing the visual identity for the Fazer cafes. And for our listeners, Fazer is the most historic chocolate manufacturer in Finland, and a brand, one of the perhaps the most loved brand in Finland, and they also have a cafe in central Helsinki. Tell me a little bit about that design process, and a brand that people have a very strong connection to and a lot of love for.
Yeah, of course, it was again about the heritage, how we bring it to this day and refresh it some way. And inspiration for that project came from the very old signets we found here in Helsinki from the cafe in the center of Helsinki. And we created this custom, very bold custom typography based on that old signets. And then the new logo was crafted from that custom type. And basically the whole identity of the packaging and the brand experience in the cafes and the different products, it was based on this very bold custom type.
How does the interaction with the client go when designing something as important as the logo, that especially for a historic brand? Is it, do you have to force your way, like, no, this is the new logo, and I don't know, how frictionless is the design process?
Well, overall, like often when it comes to logo, it's the most tricky element in the identity, because it's something like a lot of companies, They see their logo, it's kind of iconic element, and when you touch it, they are really, really like, it's not a very easy issue to handle with. We get a lot of emails and companies contacting us just to design a logo. But as I mentioned, we see like in our design process, logo is still like one element among other identity elements, and we always try to avoid those situations like designing just a logo, getting bits out of its context, and we try to sell the whole identity in those cases. But of course, it's still like a lot of companies, they see the logo is the identity, and that's kind of old-fashioned way of thinking.
That's interesting. Why do you think that is?
I'm sure like in the old days, the logo was the thing people recognized from the brand. But nowadays, maybe it's part of because there's so many of these different touch points where you have to build the brand experience, and you cannot do it with just a logo. You need some other elements and something that people can engage with. And the logo, if you play only with the logo, it's really poor palette of brand elements.
Thanks to Monocle's Petri Bertsov in Helsinki, speaking to Kokkoro & Moi's CEO and creative director, Antti Hinkola.
The biggest names in art, culture, politics, design and more are back for a sensational eighth season of The Big Interview on Monocle 24. Hear our editors in conversation with people whose stories, secrets and successes are sure to inspire. From a record-breaking artist...
I mean, there were a lot of fascinating things about art school. Now, we were kids, but every now and then you would pass by a room and somebody would come out the door and you would look in there. You would see there were naked people in there.
To a global leader fighting climate change.
Democracy is complex and messy, but it's a much more responsive and safe system. And we have to understand that we need now to defend much more vigorously the values that we took for granted.
And there's more. The godmother of New Wave Cinema, an investigative journalist and best-selling authors are among the inspiring voices you'll hear on The Big Interview. Tune in every Sunday at 9 a.m. London time, anytime as podcasts, or better still, subscribe so you never miss an episode. The Big Interview on Monocle 24.
Monocle's book team has been busy at work on our upcoming Chicago guide out this spring. The city's known for its impressive skyscrapers and naturally our always willing to leave his post Toronto Bureau Chief Tomos Lewis, who worked on the guide, decided to take a bit of a view of the city. In his essay-turned-monologue, he explores one high-rise in particular, the Gothic Revival Tribune Tower. Take it away, Tomos.
Towers, it might seem obvious to say, are meant to tower. To rise, to soar, to draw the eye up into the sky. Towers are aspirational. From the outside at ground level, they make us feel small. From the inside at the top, they make us feel like kings. It's in this vein that, in 1922, the Chicago Tribune launched a competition for a new downtown headquarters to mark its 75th birthday. The completed tower, according to the most influential of the Tribune's publishers at the time, Colonel Robert McCormick, should be, and I quote, the most beautiful building in the world. Beauty, in this sense too, meant height. The new Tribune Tower should be at the forefront of the burgeoning architectural practice of building up. This was something that Chicago, like New York, was increasingly making a hallmark of its built form, fashioning structures to echo its economic, cultural, and political ascendancy. That ambition came at a time when skyscraper, a nautical term that denoted the mast or sail of a tall ship, was cementing itself in the lexicon of architecture for buildings that soared. And the prize money, some $100,000, reflected the prestige of the commission. The Tribune wanted to make a statement, says Jonathan Solomon, Director of Architecture, Interior Architecture and Design Object at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. In order to do that, he says, it publicised the competition worldwide, and that's where the architectural imagination of the building came from. Some 260 entries were submitted from 23 countries and spanned the gamut of the ascendant architectural philosophies of the time. The designs included Eliel Saarinen's second-placed entry, a stepped church-like tower that would itself become an influential blueprint for several skyscrapers built in Chicago in the years following the competition. Then there was Austrian architect Adolf Loos's fanciful design of an oversized Doric column. Designed to reflect the newspaper columns published daily by the Tribune and arguably the pillars that sustained the principles of journalism more broadly. That design, too, would become highly influential among postmodern architects. Its design is unique, says Jonathan Solomon of the winning entry by Raymond Hood and John Mead Howells, who would later go on to design Rockefeller Plaza in New York City. Located on Michigan Avenue across the street from the Wrigley Building and near Chicago's original settlement, the site plays an important role in the city's history. It remains a site of experimentation, Solomon says, imagination and about the future of what the tower is as a form. The architects conceived a neo-Gothic tower, a cathedral of sorts to both journalism and to commerce. It was inspired by French cathedral architecture, something critics decried at the time, declaring that the winning building looked back architecturally rather than forward to Chicago's future. The tower aimed to assert Chicago's ascendant status as a world city in quirkier and perhaps more controversial ways too. During its construction, the Tribune's foreign correspondents were tasked with retrieving fragments of some of the world's great landmarks, which would later be studded into the outer walls at street level. There are today 149 rocks pocked into the tower, including fragments of the Taj Mahal, the Great Wall of China, a piece of the dome of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, a gargoyle from the Palace of Westminster in London, and even a piece of the White House. A steel fragment from the collapsed World Trade Center towers in New York was added after the attacks of September 11th in 2001. When the completed building opened its doors in 1925, nearly 20,000 Chicagoans showed up to see their city's latest architectural marvel. Judges and society matrons, folks from out of town, a mother with a couple of perspiring children dragging at her arms, a sister in her heavy black robes, an old fellow who boasted he'd read the Tribune for 35 years, all these and many more packed themselves into the lobby of the tower and swarmed over every one of its 34 floors, the Tribune reported at the time. Where the Tribune Tower spoke through architecture of Chicago's ambitions as a city, its aspirations and its sense of itself, Chicago's urban landscape now is evoking a different kind of character and urban aspiration. It's on the ground rather than in the sky that many of the city's most novel architectural work is underway, in several public parks. From the Stony Island Arts Bank to Chicago's very own iteration of the High Line idea. Skyscrapers have always been the landmarks of capitalism, says Solomon. They are the architectural type of capitalism and they come to mean different things over time. The Tribune Tower, he says, was built for a journalism corporation. And we can, I suppose, lament the state or value of journalism today, he says. It's worth noting that the Chicago Tribune sold the tower in 2017 and the building is currently being repurposed as a hotel. That long, slow shift in focus reveals something about the kind of city Chicago would like to be. Chicago still thinks of itself at the cutting edge of architectural thought, Jonathan Solomon tells me. But I think we're moving into a different phase. If you look at the way the city is treating its landscapes, the quality of parks, the public role they play, and the willingness of the city to embrace and invest in that has become incredibly important, he says. Capturing the value of that is really exciting and will have repercussions around the globe. For Monocle, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Many thanks to our often absentee Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis, who's inexplicably in Chicago there. Now, if you were to take a stroll up Fifth Avenue in New York, or for that matter, Regent Street here in London some years ago, you'd notice a subtle difference in the storefronts of the household name fashion brands. And we're not just talking about the window displays. But of late, a spate of luxury brands have been tinkering with their typefaces at a remarkable rate. Yves Saint Laurent, Diane von Furstenberg, and Burberry have all opted for refreshed sans-serif looks, a marked difference from the calligraphic logos of the past. So if fashion is all about individuality, why are so many leading names now travelling in the same design direction? That's a question we put to journalist and Bloomberg Businessweek contributor Rob Walker. Rob spoke to Monocle's Ben Rylan, remember him, and started by explaining why, in a world where brands are trying to stand out, their logos are all becoming a little samey.
Brands spend, you know, half their time trying to stand out, but also, if you think about it, half the time trying to fit in and not look dated or left behind, or just hitting the wrong note, you know what I mean? And there's a funny example that I just read today of how, you know, this the question that you're asking of like how we've ended up with this thing where so many of the typography decisions that luxury brands have made seem to fall somewhere in the general realm of Gotham, which is just for lay reader, like kind of all capital, sharp-edged letters, very stark, no serifs, bold. And this is, I talk in particular about one of the examples we use is Burberry, which moved away from a sort of Bodini-like font, which had a lot of delicate angles and serifs and sort of a thick, thin, looked like something sort of classic carved into the side of a building or something like that. But, and you know, it looked great in a way, but it was kind of, so we use this as an example of like kind of starting to look maybe a little yesterday, a little like not luxury brand, but luxury brand of the past. So they made this move to, you know, sans serif, bold Gotham font that, as we show in the piece, looks kind of like a lot of other things. And I think it drives designers crazy because they feel like, well, everyone's just falling in line. But, you know, you're trying to communicate with the consumer as well as the designer, and you want it to feel right. And there's been this gradual move to what I mean, you can never really explain these things, but I think there's been a combination of the bolder type works better on screens than the delicate type. And that's really important now, especially small screens. And then secondarily, I think that there is a move away from, like, there's something about these bolder type treatments that suggests kind of usefulness, utility. It's not just that it's fancy, it's that it's really solid and really good.
Well, it is a bit of a delicate tightrope walk, isn't it, between this idea of a timeless design that will take you through, but then also wanting to remain on trend and in fashion and as though you are ahead of the pack when it comes to what is on vogue at any particular time. But how do you see the contrast between companies that have stuck at a particular look? I'm thinking of something like Paramount Pictures, which of course isn't a fashion company at all. But when you look at its branding, you can see that it has remained pretty much the same since the studio was created way back in the 1920s. I suppose my question is there a value to be had in remaining with the same look and feel? Because for a company like Paramount, they do own that look and feel of their typography now, to the point where if you see anything written in that same style, you'll probably think of that company straight away. That's a good position to be in for a brand, is it not?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. And it's the hardest decision for brands and designers to make, is to say, like, you know what? Leave it like it is. It's really hard. And even the things that you think have stayed like they are, like there's a famous compare and contrast of the Coca-Cola logo to the 10 different treatments that Pepsi has used over the time that it's existed. They're all totally different. It's a little misleading. The Coke logo has actually been slightly tweaked over time to like keep it just slightly fresh, but it's done so subtly that they're not going to put out a press release or anything. They can't make it a branding event. And that's a really hard decision, because it's kind of easy to make a change. It's sort of a myth that change is so hard. You know, it gives you some exciting thing. The Burberry thing coincided with their most recent runway show, so it was part of the event. So it's hard to stand pat, but sometimes it really pays off. You can really own a look in a way that's just impossible to recreate overnight.
You've described it in your piece as, well, certainly as Burberry's logo, as far as that one goes, that it's not very different from those of other fashion brands, but that's also by design, as you've put it. So are we really looking at here not so much that a sans serif font is in fashion, but that maybe not standing out is currently in fashion, and the concept of what it means to have a brand and what it means to be individual might be going through some sort of evolution of its own?
Yeah, I would think so. Now, I should, for the record, Peter Saville, who did that redesign of the Burberry thing, I know would strongly disagree with my assessment that they're all just kind of fit in and it's not about standing out. I mean, he sees it as being very distinct. And you know, technically, they're not just using off-the-shelf type. They resemble things like Gotham, but they are custom, so they can be trademarked. And I think that his point of view had less to do with how it's responding to the market or to competitors, and more to do with how it's responding to the idea of what Burberry is and what Burberry wants to be. He made this interesting comparison to the Range Rover logo, which like this simultaneous luxury and utility connotation. So he's looking at references completely outside of the luxury fashion context. So I think that there's a lot of truth to what you're saying, but also in any given case, there's always the individual situation and what the immediate influences are can vary a lot.
Now that you've been through, no doubt, a lot of branding redesigns and studied a lot of different typography in different markets, what's your final analysis of some of the companies that you have cited in your piece? We know we just discussed Burberry, but of course Rimowa is also mentioned here, Saint Laurent and Diane von Furstenberg. How do you see them fitting in to the markets that they're in right now? Do you think that the simplification of the typography around those brands is actually working for them now?
Well, I mean, kind of what I was saying earlier, that I sort of wonder if 5 years from now, a lot of them aren't going to look up and say, this is a problem, like we all look alike. I think that that's an issue that would give me a lot of pause if I were directly involved in any of these things. I started to mention earlier, I saw an example today of, you know, Payless, the discount shoe store.
Of course, yes.
Okay, I know so that, yeah. Like super cheap shoes, right? They made a fake pop-up store where they put their same $20 shoes in, you know, glass vitrines in a well-lit space and invited a bunch of hipsters and influencers and fooled people who thought that their shoes were worth $500. And they renamed themselves Paylessy. Just they took out the Y and added an I at the end. And I was dying to see, I had to go look it up to see what the typography choice they made was. And it's this exact same thing, this exact same sans serif bold font. It's like, of course, because that's the typographic treatment that sends this message right now. In the same way that, you know, you can picture the store that I'm describing, like really white floors and glass shelving and things like this. And there's a moment where that looks cool, and then there's a moment when that looks really dated. And typography falls in the same thing. So I think the brilliant stunt by Payless showing the power of context for displaying and selling goods, but also so on trend as to be like almost a joke. And that's when you get, if you're not running the fake Paylessy brand and you're running an actual luxury brand, you have to worry about being caught on the wrong side of that moment.
Sincere thanks there to Rob Walker, a columnist and branding expert, speaking to Monocle's Ben Rylan. And sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by our talented menagerie of studio editors here at Midori House in London's Marylebone. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.